Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Holly Rubinstein. I'm a journalist and editor. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Today, I'm joined by Peter Grunert, the editor of Lonely Planet magazine. In fact, Peter is the editor of 13 editions of the magazine around the world, and each is imbued with that spirit of adventure and a cultural understanding that makes it one of my favorite travel magazines. And as a result of our chat, I've added about 10 new destinations to my bucket list. We'll be talking about so many great places, from Bhutan and India to Uruguay and Australia and many more, which is why this is my first long-haul episode. So here is a real deep dive into the world of travel from one of its top experts. I hope you enjoy it. So we're in the central London offices of Lonely Planet in Barcelona room, feeling very inspired already. Welcome, Peter, to the Travel Diaries podcast.
Thank you, Holly.
Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
Yeah, excellent. Thank you.
We're going to go through the travel diaries of your life so far. So looking forward to hearing the places that you've been. Let's kick off with chapter one, and that is your earliest travel memory.
My earliest memory is filtered in the way, actually, that it was from when I was 4 years old, and in the way that children filter out so many details about a location. We're not thinking about the culture necessarily or the look of the landscape, but very specific things prod your memory. Mm-hmm. And so for me, so we went to Wales. Mm-hmm. And having done some research, I realized it was in Gwynedd, and I was there on the 16th of August, 1977. And I'll tell you the reason I know this. That's the day that Elvis died. So sorry to start this on a maudlin note, but I was in the kitchen in a farmhouse in a very rainy and muddy part of Wales. And it came on the radio, on the news. My mother, father, my uncle and auntie were there, and they were all looking close to tears and horrified. And the news came that somebody called Elvis had died. And to a four-year-old, I was, who is Elvis? What a strange name. Simultaneously, that was also in that kitchen at that moment was the first time I ever ate chips, as in French fries. So yeah. Weirdly, they're two memories, and I just remember a lot of mud.
Was Wales a place that you went to a lot growing up? Was travel a big feature in your childhood growing up?
No, that's the answer. So my family background is, I don't know, I'm kind of interested in the psychology of why we didn't travel. Mm-hmm. And what's led me to work for Lonely Planet to make my career as a travel writer and editor. So my grandfather was a very adventurous person. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of family legends, but one of them goes that at the age of 12, he ran away from his home in Hull, ended up in South America working on cargo ships. At the age of 16, came back to the UK, lied about his age, joined the Royal Army Air Corps, was flying fighter planes in the Second World War, was flying boats, protecting the Atlantic convoys coming in from the USA.
Wow.
And then in the very early days of airlines, so through into the late 1940s, all through the 1950s, he was an airline pilot. And my father grew up living all around the world, because in those days, if you were a pilot for BOAC, as my grandfather was, you often were stationed in different locations. Mm-hmm. So my father, when he was growing up, he spent time in Sydney, Tokyo, Honolulu, Calcutta, San Francisco. He led this incredibly international existence.
Unbelievable.
Which, to my mind, growing up in a sleepy village on the south coast of England, just sounded so exciting and
so exotic.
Frankly, he always made it sound exciting. But for him, he reached a point in adulthood where he felt like he traveled enough. Mm-hmm. And he actually, I feel, wanted a settled existence for his family, and he saw some of the benefits of that. So we grew up in a village called West Wittering in West Sussex.
Oh, no way.
Which is beautiful.
Beautiful place. Nicely, yeah. I was literally just there last week.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, my family still live there, and you know, it's great for kite surfing and yacht sailing, those kind of things. And it was very nice. It was great for sort of micro adventures as a child, always being outdoors.
Were you an adventurous child? Did you have the wanderlust from an early age, would you say?
I think so. I spent a lot of time staring at photos, staring at pictures all about places, exciting places in the world.
Chapter 2 is the first place you fell in love with. What would that be?
Okay, so continuing our theme, the most exotic place I went to as a child was Brittany in France.
Just over on the channel.
Finally, I was allowed a passport at about the age of 8 years old. And we went on a family camping trip in somewhere called Morgaz-sur-Mer. And I just remember this spectacular beach with these amazing rock pools just full of colourful fish and anemones, sea urchins. For me as a young child, it was so exciting. And eating crepes out there as well, you know, chocolate and going off exploring. Again, a filtered memory of this, but I remember lots of hedgehogs and lots of toads. These are the things that I went off in hedgerows and found. So camping, it's something I feel I'd love, it's a place I would love to take my daughter back to now.
Yeah.
And just to relive some of the nostalgia. It was an absolutely beautiful part of the world.
And at what point then, having studied zoology, did you end up being a travel writer, an editor?
I'm not sure I should admit to this, but I had dual passions. So I've always loved wildlife, always been interested in it. I've always been incredibly nerdy about cars as well. I like machines, actually. I like mechanical devices of all sorts, watches, planes, cars. I really like old cars. I have an old Mercedes now that I drive around in. So actually my first job was for Top Gear, BBC Top Gear. And I spent 12 years at Top Gear magazine.
Oh, that's a long
stint. Deputy editor for 5 years. And I finally left that world actually of road testing cars and writing about cars when the BBC sent me to Mumbai in India. And if you don't mind me going into a segue onto the next chapter.
Sure, if you don't please mind. Segue away.
I think perhaps you told me to have a think about the trip where I learned the most about myself.
Absolutely, chapter 3.
Thank you very much. So if you can call it a trip, I spent quite a long time in Mumbai and I was helping the BBC to launch Top Gear in India, which was a highly eccentric experience in itself. And so through that work, I got to meet lots of different people in India. I also got to travel a lot in India over 6 months.
Six months out there.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was actually at the end of that I was offered the job by the BBC, which at the time owned Lonely Planet, to set up their magazines.
Oh, I see.
So that was the link there. But for me, I got into driving myself around India, which is quite an unusual thing to do.
Brave.
Yeah. I think I'm such a bad passenger that I trust my own driving so much more than anyone else's, that even though it was wild and chaotic, over a period of months living there, I realized, as people see in India, there is an order in chaos. And I felt actually there are so many people wanting to help you out in India. So there's such approachability in general, wherever you go, that I felt people were constantly there ready to help me. So I found it quite a release to drive myself around. I did have a strange experience. One of the assignments I was involved in was meeting a gentleman who had imported one of the first new Lamborghinis to India. He lived in a town called Pune, a big city, in fact. And he was driving, he wanted to drive this yellow Lamborghini, but the roads were full of potholes. And he had a chauffeur in a brand new Rolls Royce who went in front of this Lamborghini, and we weren't allowed to take photos of this scene, but in effect, we drove at 20 miles an hour everywhere, and the chauffeur's job in this £400,000 Rolls Royce was to, let's say, ask the rickshaw drivers to move out the way and not bash into the Lamborghini as this guy came through. So that was a surreal experience. And I made a lot of friends in India, and I felt I had the traffic in the south of Mumbai is famously terrible. The city's on a peninsula, and they're quite narrow access points to the business districts and downtown. So I spent a lot of time getting from my flat to my office. I was also there during the time of the monsoons coming through. And so I spent a long time in traffic jams, in the rain, staring out the window at all of the random things that happen at the roadside in a big Indian city. But I'll say beyond finding a trust in order through chaos, which made me a much more relaxed person when I came back to the UK, There was a family I saw every day as I went to work. There was a school bus parked in a lay-by, and I saw this family who were street dwellers. They slept underneath this bus, but they had a young boy and a young girl in their family, and I saw them washing their children every day. A shopkeeper gave them a big bucket of hot soapy water, and I could see the mother washing the children. And while the little boy was getting ready, the girl was already in her uniform usually, and she'd sit there with a different textbook almost every day. And just, I think sometimes as an outsider, I didn't really understand until I saw that about what social climbing means in India. And even at times, if you're a street dweller, so many people in cities in India are on a journey somewhere else. And I really had that feeling of this family valued education as an incredibly precious asset. It just made me challenge my own perceptions about taking things for granted. And a lot of people say that when they travel.
Absolutely.
Of course, perhaps it's a cliche about India to say that, but for me, it made me so grateful for what I have. It made me want to tell my daughter about that experience. I was glad for that.
What were the kind of some standout experiences of living in that country? I mean, for people who haven't traveled there before, in fact, I've never been to India. What's it like?
So I suppose it's fair to say before I started traveling, I had a nervousness about getting ill, about what can go wrong. But I have traveled to so many different countries now. And by the time I went to India, I had obviously traveled quite a lot. I'm almost too casual about these things, I'd say. I'm also a very social person. So what I loved about India was how forward a lot of my acquaintances were. There were no glossing over. You know, if you're looking a bit funny that day, if your hair's all over the place, then your colleagues will grab it and say, "What's wrong with you? You know, why are you looking so overweight? You need to sort yourself out." And how tactile a lot of people, I found that quite relaxing to be around once you get used to it. Probably the peak of all of that for me was in a festival called the Ganesh Chaturthi, which is it's a moment they call Visarjan, which is where almost the patron god, if you like, of Mumbai, of Bombay, is Ganesh. And for Hindus, obviously, and people in their households, they have a plaster of Paris statue of Ganesh, but some people who live in large apartment blocks all club together and have these huge plaster statues of Ganesh made and painted.
Wow.
And they carry them down to the ocean during this festival, and they release them out into the sea. And there's a sense of renewal through the release of Ganesh into the ocean. Millions of people come on the streets during this time.
So it's a ritual that they
go
through.
But it's a very happy ritual. There's fireworks and, you know, just like Holi, there's colourful powder being thrown around. Some people are a bit tipsy, let's say. We went down to Chaupati, which is one of the main beaches in South Mumbai. And we heard there were 300,000 people just on this one beach. And it just started to rain a bit. As I said, it was around the time of the monsoons. So I put my umbrella up, and then just suddenly I realized that there were five men hugging me. And it was because I was the only one with an umbrella in the vicinity. And there was just no reluctance by those people to make use of my umbrella with me. And they were just all hugging me. And I'm just looking at them thinking, all right, I'll go with this. This is fine. Enjoy the umbrella. Why should I selfishly stand in the corner somewhere?
So it's the people that really stood out to you.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I guess, and the food, actually. I really love spicy food. We didn't eat a lot of spicy food in West Wittering growing up, so perhaps that's my own little rebellion as well there. But
so when you go back to India, what would you order?
Gosh, well, if I'm in Mumbai, I would go, I hope it's still there, actually. There's a restaurant I used to love called Britannia. Mm-hmm. So Britannia was run by a very elderly gentleman who is of a community that they call the Parsis, who left, in effect, what is Iran now. So he made a dish called chicken berry pulao, which is, it's a pulao, so it's got these barberries in it, and the spicy chicken. It's kind of like a biryani, really, I suppose. But it was fun, you know, it was really a really fun place.
And then you were saying that while you were having spent your time out in India working on the Top Gear mag, that was at the time that you then transitioned to Lonely Planet.
That's right, yeah. So my boss, who was one of the bosses of the BBC, actually got a bit drunk with me in a hotel bar and said that he was en route to Melbourne, Australia to meet Tony and Maureen Wheeler, who were the founders of Lonely Planet,
yeah,
back in the early 1970s. And he was there to set up a deal with them to partially purchase Lonely Planet. So that's the point at which we discussed Lonely Planet's got a huge heritage of making brilliant guidebooks, the leading guidebook publisher in the world. But wouldn't it be amazing if Lonely Planet could make travel magazines as well, and not just help people to facilitate their travels, but to do more to inspire their travels? So I really saw how storytelling could make a difference there.
Mm. And did you go? I mean, we all did, right? We all grew up with Lonely Planet guides. So are there any that are very well leafed in from your childhood or your youth?
I think the guide that led me furthest astray in my youth was the Japan guide. I'd always been quite obsessed with Japan, and I liked anime and manga. I was excited to go to Japan. I like Japanese cars as well. So, I took a Lonely Planet guide a couple of times to Japan, and it's a country I feel... You can only scratch the surface of the culture in Japan on each visit, and there's so much to begin to understand and discover. Looking at Instagram, for example, I'm quite a visual person. I really enjoy photography, so I might use Instagram as a planning tool just to get a sense of what things look like, but only in those lighting conditions, in that place, with that.
So looking at the location, the tagged location, and then seeing kind of what people are doing in that location?
Yeah, I'm interested. Frankly, I'm interested in the brilliant pictures on Instagram and the dreadful ones as well, because they give me a sense of who are the highly skillful photographers I know on Instagram, but who's giving a less filtered view, let's say, which isn't necessarily always more authentic. Some people underrepresent just how staggeringly beautiful a place is in their photography.
With the dawn of social media and the popularity of Instagram, does that affect the kind of places that you choose to cover within the magazine now? Are you looking at places more through what would make a good photo for somebody, or are travellers thinking that way too?
Well, it's an interesting question, and I'll talk specifically for our magazines. So mm-hmm. We have 13 editions of our magazine in countries all around the world. So there are different cultural takes in each of those locations. What is an inspiring photograph? What is an inspiring destination? I think it's for us to offer a degree of originality. And if we are trying to take photographs in a place, we'd hope we would inspire our readers to go there and photograph those places as well.
Yeah.
But we are very wary of certain kinds of over-tourism, which is such a topic at the moment that we're all discussing. We don't want to typically be prescriptive about don't go to St. Mark's Square in Venice. We don't want to say that, but we want to arm the traveller with options. To say, if you go there at that time, as that big cruise ship's coming in, it may be rammed and that may not be for you. And local people sometimes may find that very difficult to cope with. Mm-hmm. Infrastructure may strain. There is this other neighborhood that's 15 minutes walk away that has these beautiful buildings, has all of this culture, has a sense of local life, which if that is appealing to you as a traveler, we're just telling you it's there as well. I say this having been to Venice last autumn with my daughter and seen the beauty of St. Mark's Square and the Basilica there. But we stayed in Cannareggio, which is just around the corner, and we were glad for that side to the city as well, and felt very privileged to see that.
Mm-hmm.
I actually felt quite annoyed, I will say this, about how infrequently on Instagram, amongst different travellers or in travel media, anyone bothers to just go that 15 minutes further over. But I guess that's my job, to put those options out there.
Speaking of beautiful places like Venice, chapter 4 is your all-time favourite destination. What would that be?
Well, I started earlier by saying to you, Holly, that my father inspired me a lot when I was growing up by sharing photographs from his childhood. Mm-hmm. He spent 2 years in Australia, and he showed me these amazing 1950s tiny little photos printed in Kodachrome. So they had this amazing bleached out sort of pastel colors going on, which I just found so atmospheric.
Yeah.
Talking about fishing trips and sharks circling around, you know, where he lived in Sydney, in this area called Vaucluse at the end of their garden, and, you know, going off looking for lizards and all sorts, you know, iguanas, all sorts of things out in the bush, going on a big drive with his father into the outback. I found these things just so exciting. And I lived in rural West Sussex, as we said. So for me, early in my career, 10 years ago at Lonely Planet, going to Australia was a huge moment for me. So I wrote a feature about traveling in South Australia. It was such a privilege to be there. And so I traveled around, and it was about meeting different characters who've chosen to live in this extremely remote environment and quite different environments.
So what is South Australia like in contrast to, and what are the major kind of cities that we might know in that part of Australia?
So we flew into Adelaide.
Adelaide, right.
And we quite quickly left Adelaide, and we went up the coast first and foremost,
right,
to a place called Port Lincoln. So we went into the outback. We met all these ranchers. We met some Aboriginal people who took us on a bushwalk. And actually, before I hype up my own adventurous spirit too far, I'm going to make a confession, which is we set up what I thought was a bush tucker experience. So I thought I'd walk for 1 or 2 days with a Aboriginal guide, and he'd show me, you know, witchetty grubs and other things that would
I'm a
celebrity, maybe I'd watch that too much. So he turned up in a brand new Land Rover Discovery, and he lowered the tailgate, and he got out a bottle of wine and a picnic hamper, and he said, "I've baked you some scones, and I've been out gathering." It's the Kwandong season. So Kwandongs are these fruits that grow. They have an amazing taste.
I've never heard of them. What
are
they?
It's a kind of fruit which they grow in a tree, I understand. And I describe the taste as somewhere between a mandarin orange and a guava, if that means anything. Sort of
right.
Like a tropical fruit sort of taste. And he'd made jam from these. He'd baked these scones. So it's cream scones and Kwandong jam. We sat on the tailgate watching the sunset and feasting on scones. So that's about us. Extreme as my bush tucker experience went. We ended up in a place called Coober-Pedy. So Coober-Pedy is well known for being an opal mining town. And you get these people who live there who lease a plot. And it's that whole thing about what is it to be a prospector, to try and seek your fortune in this desert environment. Everywhere you go, there are signs saying don't walk backwards, because there are just individual very deep mine shafts sunk all over the place, and it gets incredibly hot there, of course, during the daytime. So a lot of these people actually have built underground dwellings. So we actually went and stayed in a hotel which was underground, and we met people who live in this environment
without any windows.
You need the insulation of the ground. They're quite deep underground, some of them. That's how people choose to live and often don't make their fortune. That's the reality.
Was the hotel busy and booked up?
It was a pretty strange flight on the way there. There were big signs about check in your explosives and handguns before you get on the flight. You know, there's a lot of people carting dynamite out, I guess.
How about your favourite city? What would that be?
Okay, so returning to Japan, I had a 2-week holiday with my wife in Tokyo. I really like the film Lost in Translation. We determined that we would do a complete follow along of Lost in Translation.
So we
stayed in the Park Hyatt, in the hotel that they stayed in. We went to the bar where Bill Murray sat there chatting to Scarlett Johansson. We went to the Akihabara Electric Light District. We went to Harajuku, where there are all the different sort of tribes, who went to a Snoopy superstore. And anyway, we really slightly obsessively followed. It was so much fun. It was brilliant. And I think what I most love about that film is an atmosphere that you get in a very different place when you're jet lagged, when it's sort of night, often nighttime, there's that fog in your brain and so much is coming at you and slowly the mist clears and you start to settle into the rhythm of a place. And that's definitely how it felt for us in Tokyo.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Speaking of hotels, what would you say is your all-time favorite hotel?
So if I had to say the one hotel I'd most like to return to and had the best experience in, it was called Mashpee Lodge. So Mashpee Lodge is in Ecuador. It's in the cloud forest of Ecuador, which is a very special environment. It's at higher altitude than normal rainforest. And this place, just the wildlife comes to you there. It was actually built on the location of a former logging camp. And the owner of the hotel bought that site and demolished the logging camp and built this incredible modern boutique hotel in the middle of the jungle.
Wow.
And the guide who took us around had used to work in the logging camp, trying to survive through working in deforestation. But the owner of the hotel realized that this guy, over the many years he'd lived in this forest, had built up such incredible knowledge of the plants and the creatures there.
And what kind of things did he see?
Well, huge bugs, actually. There was a thing called a Hercules beetle, which was I took a photo of it. It was the size of my notebook. Giant moths and leaf insects.
Eight-legged things.
You know what? Actually, sadly, I didn't see a tarantula, but I would very much like to have.
Sadly?
Yeah, I love all the creepy crawlies.
Oh, do you? Oh, gosh. That's the one thing I'd like to avoid when I'm traveling.
We saw these quite spooky animals called tyras. So tyras are like giant black ferrets, and they came out of the jungle and they look, I don't know, they have a sort of malevolent glint in their eye, but they were actually just looking for fruit to feed on. There were a lot of hummingbirds as well, and just such, they're so incredibly beautiful. And just the sound, again, the sound that their wings make when they're right by your ears.
Sounds amazing.
It's a lovely place.
One to add to the bucket list.
Yeah.
And how about in the kind of spirit of Lonely Planet's original ethos, a destination on a shoestring?
If I go back to the origins of Lonely Planet, Tony and Maureen Wheeler wrote really a pamphlet, which was Across Asia on the Cheap. So as students, they bought a mini. This was in 1972, I think. They drove to Kabul, as you could in those days. They sold their mini for a profit, and then they continued overland. through all different means of transport, and they went through Southeast Asia, India, ended up in Australia, and that's where they wrote this first guidebook. And India was one of our first ever guidebooks. After that, as the company got started, and back then we'd have said India is one of the world's greatest on a shoestring destinations, and still I say that. I have to say India just gives travelers of all types such huge diversity of experience and hugely varying budget options as well. And I personally feel the richness really of being in India comes from absorbing the culture and being in the environment more than anything. And for me, although there's some amazing palaces you can stay in, and some of them are actually really affordable in Rajasthan, for example, there's something just so special about being in different parts of India. And I should say, I feel India's more of a continent almost than a country, because each state has such a diverse character. And if I had to say my favorite state, if I were to be there as a budget traveler now, I'd love to return to Kerala. There's something about the tropical abundance in that place, I'd say.
It's a very watery part of India, isn't it?
It is, exactly, yes. And you're right. So, you know, we went out on the backwaters. We went on these sort of rice barges called Ketuvalem, and we traveled around in canoes as well with villagers, went fishing and seeing kingfishers and otters. And I'm back to the wildlife, but... all of those experiences are manageable on a very low budget, and the food, just the prawns, giant prawns we're eating, just the freshness of the spices, the coconut in the food so much there.
And is it a good entry point maybe for somebody who might think that some of the cities of India could be a bit overwhelming? Is it a good kind of entry point to getting a taste of what India has to offer?
That's a very good point. There is just a more relaxed general atmosphere in the state, I'd say. Again, it's a generalization. I should be careful with that. But getting out into the backwaters, you'd really feel the pace winding down.
Chapter 5 is your hidden gem. Well, I'm sure there are quite a few hidden gems that you have uncovered along the way. What stands out?
Okay, so if you don't mind, I'm going to hit you with two.
Oh, please.
One very close to home and one very far away.
Great.
So I'll start distant. So I went to Bhutan and reported from Bhutan.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
And it had been hovering around the top of my bucket list for a long time. And I'm quite strange in as much as I like to keep things in front of me as some kind of motivation and incentive. So yeah. I resisted discovering Bhutan for myself for many years because I wanted to keep it hanging there. But finally, I got around to it. Now, Bhutan didn't really allow tourists in until about 1975, and still there is a minimum cost. In certain months, it's $200 a day. Certain other months, it's $250.
It's not easy to visit, is it?
It's very hard. Yeah, you're right. And even just accessing Bhutan involves an adventurous flight. The main airport is at quite high altitude, and there's only one kind of airliner that's been adapted with special engines to fly and land in a short space coming in at high altitude. So most people come from Kathmandu. I think you can come in from India from Kolkata as well. So we flew in via Kathmandu. You fly over Everest. So already just to see Everest looming up is mind-blowing. I was reading about the same experience the other day, and somebody said seeing Everest for the first time is like meeting a celebrity and being starstruck. And it felt like that for me seeing it. So yeah, you land at the airport.
And it's meant to be like quite a hair-raising landing, isn't it? Between the peaks.
Yeah, right. We didn't manage it the first time. We had to do a sort of a roundabout and come in and take aim the second time. Kind of enjoyed it in a weird way.
Yeah.
It's a country where a lot of people in their day-to-day lives wear national costume. The men wear an outfit called a go, which is a kind of tunic, a sort of checked tunic with giant cuffs, although they'll often wear that with Nike trainers, or you know, this doesn't quite get to the
shoes.
It can be. A lot of them are more, I'm seeing maroons and dark greys, a bit more sort of sedate colors. And it's a culture, it's a kingdom, and it's a culture that's heavily influenced by a version of Buddhism, a version of Tibetan Buddhism. So you're in the Himalayas with this Tibetan Buddhism that infuses so much of the culture whilst you're there. So I was thinking about some of the experiences I had. A lot of what you do there is visiting what are called zongs. Zongs are fortified monasteries. And some of them stretch beyond medieval times. They're ancient. These white, very geometric, slightly sort of Chinese influenced in the gables and the pantiles on the roofs in their architecture. They have these just incredibly beautiful frescoes painted inside them, sort of tigers and mythical beasts. I found that so beautiful to be there with the yak butter lamps burning and, you know, giant sort of horns being blown and monks. Although the boy monks we met when we did a lot of trekking, and you're pretty much constantly at high altitude. So for me, it took quite a while to acclimatize. So my heart was beating away constantly, but we were meeting these boy monks, and of course they're just asking me about Premiership football and what's going on with Manchester United, and the power of Manchester United has reached into the furthest, least known corner of the Himalayas.
Amazing.
We chose to, there's a monastery called the Tiger's Nest, which is the most photographed site, so we trekked past that and we kept going, and we got to about 4,500 meters. And we went from very hot and sweaty, lower down at about 2,500 meters, it was very bright, intense sunlight, to heavy blizzards at the top. If you don't mind me briefly taking this in a slightly bawdy direction, I'll just say. So we were taken to lots of different farms as well as monasteries, and in rural houses, there's another form of painting that's kind of infamous for Bhutan. So the patron saint of Bhutan is somebody called Drukpa Khinle. So Drukpa Khinle was somebody who came to Bhutan promoting a certain kind of Buddhism, and his theory hundreds of years ago when he came there was to break down social conventions, and so people would be more imaginative about new teachings as well. So he'd get everybody drunk, he'd break wind, he'd have possibly romantic encounters with all kinds of women. And that's how he spread his philosophy, apparently. But he's a kind of folk hero. He's a sort of subject of laughter in Bhutan as well. But he is revered on a certain level. And so in pretty much every rural farmhouse above the front door, you'll see what is euphemistically termed as the magic thunderbolt of wisdom, which is, for want of a better term, it's an ornate phallus painted above the doorway. I'll spare you the details, but it's highly anatomically correct. And that's an auspicious sign. That's a sign of good luck, really, that you see everywhere.
Sounds charming.
Honestly, it's such a reverential sort of place. Yeah. And the general demeanor is quite calm and measured, and that vibe you get in mountain communities in so many parts of the world.
Isn't it the happiest country in the world?
Well, there is this, there was an objective set for the government to measure the success, if you like, of that country, not just in gross domestic product, but gross national happiness. Mm. Bhutan now is aiming by next year to become 100% organic as well. So this remote and not so well-known place is actually arguably one of the most progressive countries in the world, I would suggest.
And quality of life seems quite up there.
It's true. We met some Japanese tourists when we were there. And these people, I was asking our guide, you know, what brings them to Bhutan? And he said, well, for the people in this region of Bhutan we're in, partly they're interested in Buddhist culture and they see a connection to their own religion and culture there. But also people who are struggling with fertility sometimes come there, and they actually go to the temple that's Drukpa Khinle's sort of number one temple dedicated to him. Mm-hmm. And so we did go to this place and we had a blessing. So the national sport of Bhutan is archery. So we did some archery and I was blessed with a bow and arrow. And then this monk came along, sorry to go back to this, but came with a wooden phallus and touched me on the head and said, something's now going to happen. I'm just going to tell you because it always does. So sorry, this is a personal point, and not that this had crossed my mind beforehand, but I got in touch with my guide 9 months later and said, much to our surprise, my wife has just had a child.
Oh my God.
And he said, well, you know, that's amazing, that's auspicious, you know why that was, but you know the tradition is your child's middle name has to be Kunli to recognize the influence of the monk.
And is it?
No, it's not.
Oh,
my,
no.
My wife is having none of it. But still, the thought was there.
And how about the hidden gem that's
The hidden gem. So my wife comes from Bradford in West Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. I feel Bradford gets either overlooked or a bad press.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, I'm talking about having lived in India and traveled a lot in India. Some of the best South Asian cuisine I've eaten has been in Bradford. Mm-hmm. Also, as a southerner, I've finally come round to admitting that fish and chips are better in the north of England. And I'll put I'll put that down to the beef dripping that it's fried in. And for me, also, just some of the architecture in Bradford, even though some of it's not very well looked after, some of the Victorian industrial architecture, I just find it so magnificent. And what my favorite place just on the edge of Bradford is called Saltaire. So there was a Victorian gentleman called Titus Salt who built arguably the most magnificent industrial building to come out of the Industrial Revolution, which is Salt's Mill. Uh-huh. And the village he built around it with good sanitation and education, it was very progressive, is called Saltaire. And David Hockney, who's of local origin, became involved in the restoration of this mill, and a lot of his artworks are shown inside.
Oh, wonderful.
And now it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's been recognized by UNESCO. But like I say, I feel like a lot of us who aren't from West Yorkshire don't know about it.
Yeah.
It's a lovely village as well. There's, you know, lovely cafes, vintage shops, design shops. It's a place I hugely enjoy visiting.
That's a great hidden gem.
Thank you.
Chapter 6, in contrast, is the place that you'd never go back to.
Well, this place I've sworn I'll never go back to 3 times. Tells you something.
Yeah.
I've been there 5 times.
Sucker for punishment,
which is Tenerife. And I don't want to sound snobbish, but as a student, I'll just say I had some fairly grotty, cheap package holidays and, you know, fun in their own way.
Yeah.
The last time when we had a young child, I thought, look, you know, at a certain time of year in the spring when the weather's not good in the UK yet, it's just so easy to get to. There's no jet lag. The weather's good. So we did go back. And I'm going to admit now that leaving things to the last minute came and bit me. We were staring in part at an electricity pylon and in part at an abandoned building site. So it's just a mound of rust. Honestly, it was terrible. And it was raining as well. This place that's meant to be the most reliably bright and sunny place in February. So it was a disaster. And just to say on Tenerife as well, in terms of giving a place another chance, I actually bothered to go for a drive up Teide in the middle and the national park in the middle.
Yeah.
You rise through the clouds. They're really different environments. It's an incredibly high mountain, this active, or I don't know if it's active, but this volcano anyway that's there in the center, which is Spain's highest mountain. And the roads are beautifully kept. And then you're just driving through these lava fields. I feel it's a site that a lot of package holiday makers don't get to see if they don't come away from a resort, don't come away from a beach.
Yeah.
And yet within an hour's drive, you're in the middle of the island. It's such a beautiful place. A friend of mine went there last week and was messaging me and saying
he was
really glad
it.
That they bothered. Yeah.
So if you're in a really rubbish hotel, just drive to there and you'll be
up
happy.
Manteide. There's a cable car if you're really adventurous. You can go right to the top.
As both a writer of travel journalism myself and a consumer of it, I've certainly experienced places being overhyped. What would you say is the most overhyped place?
So a place that definitely on my first acquaintance with that city I felt had been hugely overhyped was LA.
Really?
Yeah.
One of my favorite cities.
Well, there you go. And so we can argue about this. Yeah. And you'll probably win, because I will admit right now that it's a giant place.
Yeah.
And you need to get out and explore and have local connections. It's about being in the right place and seeing the right things. I'm certain of that. But for me, my experience of getting there was straight to Hollywood, walking up Hollywood Boulevard, were just kind of rough and scruffy in places. And I don't know what I was expecting. I went to Beverly Hills. Maybe I'd watched Pretty Woman one time too many. And I had some 80s sort of version of what I expected from Beverly Hills. You know, I went to the Mondrian Hotel and hung around with all these people lounging around the pool. And I don't know, for me, it just
wasn't your scene.
Left me cold.
Chapter 7, then, is your next big adventure. What would that be?
Well, I am a wildlife obsessive and feel that the remnants of my bucket list today are generally hooked around wildlife experiences. So I'm really looking forward to going to a country that's currently called Eswatini. But Eswatini, until a year ago, was called Swaziland. So it's a tiny country alongside South Africa and Mozambique. And it's the only absolute monarchy in Africa. So it has a king. The king, on his 50th birthday last year, which was also the 50th anniversary of the country's independence from British colonial rule, the king, to the surprise of most people, announced that he was changing the country's name. And Eswatini, I understand, is what the country is actually known as in the local language, Siswati. You can imagine it must have caused a few marketing problems for people, say. But what I'm most looking forward to about that country is going in search of rhino. So the country is known for being brilliant at rhino conservation.
Yeah.
And they have incredibly rare black rhino there, and they have white rhino as well. And one of the things, well, there are two things I'm hoping to do. One is to go horse riding on safari. They have a particular large nature reserve that doesn't have any very large predators in it. So hoofed mammals, the rare antelope and so on that live there and known for being very calm and easy to horse ride amongst.
Wow.
The other thing they specialize in is walking experiences where you approach rhino. Which I my mind's boggling at how you do this, but I think it says something about how well trained the guides are and how well they know the individual rhino.
Oh wow, what an amazing adventure. I'm very jealous.
Looking forward to it.
So I can't be in a room with you as a voracious travel reader and not ask what you think might be next big destination for 2020. What tips could you give me?
So my tip for a big destination that's also a small destination, a small country, is Uruguay.
Uruguay,
yeah,
okay.
I'm really fascinated by Uruguay. So the country has a reputation, or I feel, for being a very progressive place, welcoming to gay and lesbian travelers. Also a country that's addressing sustainability in tourism in general, more than a lot of South American countries. And for a very compact country, it offers a real breadth of experiences that you think about. Argentina as an example of such a massive place, or Chile equally, a country that's so long and really costly to get around because it takes so long usually to fly between experiences. Whereas in Uruguay, you have some incredible vineyards, you have brilliant food experiences, cultural dancing experiences, and also really wonderful coastline as well.
Yeah.
So if you're on a lower budget, Leicester, it's a country that gets overlooked, but we would really recommend.
Absolutely. That's a great one. Thank you. Finally, then, Chapter 8 is what's at the top of your wish list, your bucket list destination.
The place I feel really calling me back, that's at the top of my bucket list, is Australia.
Yeah.
And I'm going to return to another of my obsessions, which is Sir David Attenborough. Uh-huh. I'm really fascinated by his early career. So one of my favorite individual TV programs ever broadcast, you'll find, if you have access to BBC iPlayer, you can go in there and they have a whole Attenborough archive. If you just search under Adventure Attenborough, it'll get you to this collection which he's curated. And one of the shows he's put in there is called Quest Under Capricorn, which was a TV series he made in 1963, or was broadcast in 63, about him driving in a Land Rover around the Northern Territory of Australia. And I'd love to follow in his tire tracks, if you like, to go out to this still extremely distant place. It's just something about the dust, the colour, the time. There's an episode called Hermits of Borroloola. And Borroloola is a town you can still visit. And really, at the time David Attenborough went there, it was a ghost town. So in Victorian times, cattle stations had been starting up in the Northern Territory, and this town was at that time in a convenient location for the cattle to be shipped in. But when that industry fragmented and cattle stations were set up hundreds of miles apart, then the reason for that town existing disappeared. And it was a fairly sizable town. It had a big library, for example. It had lots of shops and lots of people traveling through. But eventually it fell apart. And at the time that David Attenborough went there, there were just these three Western hermits, if you like. I mean, there were always Aboriginal people living around that, but in terms of outsiders coming in, there were just these three guys left who were remnants of that time. And so Attenborough went in search of these people.
Yeah.
And one sequence that really haunts me from that show is there's a guy who was said to actually be a British aristocrat who'd found his own... He'd been an actor, but now just wants to have no contact. So he lived by a billabong in this shack, and he wouldn't allow himself to be filmed, but he's a virtuoso violinist. So you just hear these amazing recordings of him. He just plays his violin all day.
Wow.
And you hear this beautiful violin music and see, you know, the wildfowl on this lagoon and the eucalyptus trees and the desert environment all around that. And for me, as a sort of gregarious person who works for this strangely named brand Lonely Planet, which is sort of slightly ironic. But, you know, to have that thought of actually traveling somewhere where I might be alone on my own for a period of time. I never travel like that.
Yeah.
But to go to somewhere where I will be far from other people, this tiny remnants of a town, 250 miles drive from the next settlement. And for me, that would be pushing my boundaries of adventure as far as I possibly could, just to spend a few days entirely alone in the desert.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I'll cope with it, but I feel I should try that one day.
Yeah. Fantastic. Oh, thank you so much, Peter. Those were your travel diaries. What a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Holly.
That was Peter Greenert, the group editor of Lonely Planet magazine. I've included a list of all the destinations that Peter mentions in this episode's show notes. You can find Lonely Planet magazine in all good news agents each month, and head over to their Instagram at Lonely Planet Mag for all the travel inspo you could ever need. If you've enjoyed this episode, then please tell your friends about it. Make sure you subscribe, and if you wouldn't mind leaving a review, that really helps other people to discover the podcast. And come and find me on Instagram. Say hi. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. Thanks so much for listening. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.